Petition number 11245, Reel 4.
Mr. Goldsworthy, Reel 4.
It was essential to brief the operators with as much as we could find out about the guards in the port, and also to get their give them a route of escape. Well, in fact, we asked for somebody locally to be brought out, and the British liaison officers with the partisans around Genoa arranged to bring out a port official who was anxious to help, and a light aircraft was sent in to a landing strip, and he was brought down and gave us the complete briefing of the situation there. Well, the operation, putting in the briefest terms, is was taken. They were taken up by a motor launch to within quite a short distance of Genoa. They went in and they came back and reported that they had had trouble, as they always seem to have on these occasions, and with technical equipment, but they had left the charge underneath the Aquila, and it should be enough to sink the ship. Anyway, we flew a recce the following morning, and the ship looked, as far as we could see, unharmed. It's just still alongside the quay. So they then ran a low recce, and again, it looked as if the ship didn't seem to be damaged at all, which was a great disappointment. And then shortly afterwards, everything changed, and we went sailing into Genoa. And so the first thing, and then I might say that subsequent to that, a recce showed that the Germans had evidently moved the ship, as we anticipated, across the harbour, and it was very successfully blocking the middle of this middle gateway, an enormous obstruction to be moved if it was sunk there. So naturally we wanted to know what the situation was when we got in, and we went up onto this building that we were having going to requisition. And we could see the Aquila across there. And then we did a bit more, and we went up again. And I couldn't believe my eyes. The Aquila was no longer in the blockship position. It was halfway down the harbour. So the only thing to do was to... you see, we knew already that a lot of mines had been scattered there. To us to get an urgent message away that we wanted a mooring party to secure it before it could be activate mines and to secure it in a harmless position in case it was slowly sinking. It wasn't until I got down amongst the dock workers that I found what had happened. The charge had gone off. There was an explosion multi misterioso, they said, just at the time it was supposed to be. But it had been over on one side, as they said. They put it a bit to one side of the ship, hoping they couldn't find bilge keels, I should say that. So they put it on one side, hoping that it would cause the Aquila to capsize. When you got to the ship, we found, of course, that it had had a torpedo bulge built into it during the renovations. And that torpedo bulge was on the quay side, and the effect was to rip about 15 feet of the torpedo bulge off, but not to cause an entry into the main part of the ship. So that accounted for its survival from our efforts. And then it was moved by the Germans, who then retired and had put 17 demolition charges in the bottom of the ship, retired and pressed the trigger, and nothing happened. The Italian workmen had cut the cables leading to the demolition charges. So the Aquila was a ship that defeated two navies. I subsequently wrote a radio play about that, about Operation Toast, which the BBC broadcast. But it was... That interrupted the time when my story of how we entered Genoa. Well, meanwhile, we were on our way. I must add that on our way through the port, we found about 1,000 Germans who had been the main German party in the city had all gathered into one big building for their own self-defense. Wilner and I had the 1,000 Germans offering their to surrender to us, and we had to tell them we were too busy, we just hadn't time to do it, because this was one of their big problems. The partisans were running fairly riot, and as a matter of self-preservation, they just didn't want to be caught up in it. This was the very tail end of the resistance in Italy. So once or twice, we've had, I think on my record of it, was that we had about five times that we had to abandon the jeep and go into take cover because of various outbreaks of firing between the odd partisans who were pretty irresponsible, and some of the remaining German garrison. So it was really, in fact, I think it was Wilner who said that the place was rather like driving through with our jeep with all the flowers we'd given to it. It was rather like driving through the French Revolution and a mixture of that and the car and the flowers of Nice, or I can't think of the word.
Battle of the Flowers.
Yes, flowers. We then decided for our own comfort we'd try and get a meal, and we went to the Astoria Hotel and said, could they please knock up a meal for us? We could have given them some compo rations. And the manager said, oh, certainly, sir, certainly. I'm afraid we haven't got very much. Would you like turkey or bacon and eggs? And that to us was a tremendous thing. And I sent a cable back, a message back to the rest of the party, telling them what comfort we were in. The gist of it was that everything was working in Genoa and they should come forward as soon as possible. And just to emphasize the point, we sent them a couple of bottles of wine, which was something quite unusual in those days. Anyway, after that, the advance party did come along, I think, the next day. But it was held up because one captain of a very heavy gun emplacement up on the hillside refused to surrender, and they gave him until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And his attitude was, if you try and force me to give up, then we'll fight back. If you give us time, the war will be over, and I can, without loss of my military honor, surrender to you. And there was, on the other hand, the Americans were rather anxious to establish the position quite clearly and bring shipping into towards the port and so on, because this blessed great guns had a very long range. They had a longer range than any of the ship that was available to us to bombard them. So they gave them an ultimatum, and then at 2 o'clock it finally passed. But in the meantime, and I'm still having my leg pulled about this, I had to send urgent messages to the rest of the party not to come along the coast road because of the threat from this still active gun position. Anyway, we got busy getting Genoa sorted out, and later we had a little advance party. We went down to liberate, if you use the word, Savona, which was another port along the coast. Another great day of rejoicing and so on. And one odd little thing that happened in Genoa was that while I was in Gibraltar, two Italians had been picked up on a Carli float. Their explanation was that they had been prisoners of war in Algiers, and they'd seen an Italian hospital ship in port, and they thought that if they hid away on that, they could get into the get back home to Italy. Well, unfortunately for them, the hospital ship was going in the wrong direction. And so when they got off onto the Carli float and were captured at Gibraltar, we, of course, got this explanation, and they were pretty harmless people. And they were pleading, kill us, beat us, do what you like, but don't give us back to the flaming French, because they'd been prisoners of the French there and reckoned they'd been very badly treated. So I fixed them up with a few cigarettes and made them fairly comfortable there to be treated as prisoners. And we sent them back to Algiers, but I managed to get them put into an RAF camp. Now, I was walking through Genoa when suddenly two men came rushing across the street and grabbed me and said, you were in Gibraltar, you were Gibraltar. I said, you remember us? And anyway, they apparently had been very well treated back by the RAF, so they dragged me into the nearest bar, and we celebrated their return to civilian life. There were two other small, bizarre incidents which illustrated the confusion existing in the north of Italy at that time. One day, a young man was brought up to my office in Navy House, Genoa, and he spoke quite good English, and he said that he had been in a Fuhrer regiment, and now that that war was over, he would very much like to join the Royal Navy and fight the Japanese. However, his offer was not accepted, and we sent him in the direction of the nearest prisoner of war camp. Another man who turned up who said that he claimed that he was Spanish. He was incidentally a very fair-haired German-looking lad, but he explained that by saying that he was a Catalonian, and a lot of that part of Spain, no people were fair. And he said that he had been on holiday in Germany and had been impressed into the service of the German forces as a code breaker. He told me that he was familiar with quite a number of our low security codes which were used for contact with shipping on the coast, and he was willing to tell us all about their code-breaking methods in return for a one-way ticket back to Spain. Well, of course, I was very much out of my depth on this question of codes and so on. So I sent a signal to the to Rome, and to the Commander-in-Chief's office, telling them of this offer and asking for instructions. In fact, he told me that he'd been living for a while with the partisans, and to keep his goodwill, I agreed that he should return to the group he'd been living with, and we would go and collect him if and when we had further instructions. And that was a risk, of course, because if he'd vanished, I would have looked very foolish. But in fact, he didn't, and we did collect him, and my instructions were to take him down to Pisa and then put him on an aircraft to Rome. And much later, I saw an enormously thick volume, which had apparently been produced on the information he could give us all about their code-breaking methods. But I also heard later that they were not satisfied that he was Spanish, and I think he too probably finished in a prisoner of war camp. But those two incidents give you an illustration of how confused things were. The first lad, by the way, had gone initially to Leghorn and gone to Navy House there, and apparently the sentry on the gate said, "Oh no, ships are not here now, they're all up at Genoa." And he then turned round and gone all the way to Genoa through all the confusion that was going on. Now, after my period in Genoa, I was staff officer intelligence for a short while to the Admiral down in Rome, and which gave me an opportunity to go and visit the human torpedo crews who were then working with our lads up at Venice. And finally, I went home and went on leave and eventually left the Navy. Having been in the Navy for about 5 years, I had done very little sea time. And subsequently, I did a great deal more sea time as a reporter than I ever did in uniform. The first opportunity I got then was in 1949, beginning of 1949, by which time I had moved through the Manchester office and into the Fleet Street office. There already was some tension between Britain and Russia, and possibly that may have been the reason, but it was announced that the Navy was going up to do some cold weather trials up in the Arctic, and that seemed to me an opportunity to get something unusual in the way of experiences and in the way of news stories. So I was booked to go in that party on February 1949. The fleet that was going consisted of the aircraft carrier Vengeance, the destroyers Gabbard and St. Kitts, and the little frigate Lockhart Haig. Much to my consternation, I was allocated a place on the Lockhart Haig, the smallest ship in the fleet, which would not have been by choice, but there we are. They were taking with them 40 scientists of different persuasions, doctors, engineers, metallurgists, gunnery experts, all of whom wanted to get some experience of the problems encountered in an area where the weather was so cold that the spray would be freezing as it hit the forecastle of a ship. My first 5 days, I think, were about the most miserable I ever spent, because for 3 days I was in my bunk as we went up straight steaming due north, heading for Jan Mayen Island, way up beyond Iceland and well into the beyond the Arctic Circle. There were gales running all the time with enormous seas coming in, and this little frigate was rolling and rolling and rolling. But after 3 days, I managed to get myself onto my feet, and as soon as there's a prospect of work to do, that I've always found is the great thing which can get over these sort of troubles. Having got up there, I was wanted to get rather more material than I was finding in this small ship, so I asked if I could go over to the Vengeance. Now, the Vengeance, of course, had the being the senior ship, also had quite a lot more experiments going on. And I then had my first taste of a jackstay riding. The Americans call it the high wire, which is a bit more descriptive. The idea is that the Vengeance fired a line over to the lock arcade, and that was secured onto a high point of the bridge, and it was run back over a pulley and along the deck of the aircraft carrier with a tug-of-war team of about 50 men trying to keep it taut as far as possible as the ships rolled together and rolled apart. Onto this was hooked another line with hook below it, and below that was a wire strop, and the unfortunate victim who was there for transfer had to put his foot in the fire strop, the wire strop, hold on to it, and be hauled by another tug-of-war team from one ship to the other, which I can tell you was a pretty bizarre moment. I went over and I spent the day in Vengeance, and I was due to go back to the Lock Arcade in the evening, but by then the weather was so bad that there were two very near collisions when they were trying to get the by the way, to make it plain, the two ships have to be steaming along in parallel while this is happening. There were two very near collisions, and then the Captain Perry, I think his name was, decided that he wasn't taking any chances and I should stay on board the Vengeance, very much to my great relief. I had been provided with all sorts of cold weather wear. My standard issue consisted of a string vest, two pairs of thick knitted pants, knitted cardigan, some mariner's jersey, four pairs of sea boot stockings, a duffel coat with a fur-trimmed hood, scarf, silk gloves, knitted gloves, horsehide mittens, fleece-lined mittens, balaclava helmet, kapok padded outer suit, thick as a sleeping bag, oilskin overalls and hood, and a fur-lined leather helmet, windproof suit and anti-glare goggles. Together, I know they weighed 27 pounds, and they doubled my girth. I had gone over for a day, and so I'd left most of my kit in the frigate, and it was 9 days before the weather and the operational program made it possible for me to recover it. Among the bow ties and uniforms at dinner that evening, I was clearly distinguished as a new arrival by appearing in battle dress, a mariner's jersey and sea boots. That day saw the first flying fatality since the ship was commissioned. The weather was much too bad for the fireflies, the sea furies, the firebrands and the sea vampires to take off. But the amphibious sea otter went off on a reconnaissance of the ice floes further north. I was taking pictures for my own album, not for the paper. from the Goofer's Gallery aft of the bridge as the sea otter came onto the steeply sloping deck, floated above the first wires, caught a late one, tumbled over the side, hung there for seconds, and then dropped into the sea, floating tail uppermost. It was estimated that a man could survive no more than 4 minutes in that temperature. As we watched, the chief petty officer observer struggled to the surface, and thanks to his survival suit was still alive when the shadowing destroyer picked him up 7 minutes later. But sadly, the young pilot, father of a baby born only the previous week, went down with the plane. Captain Terry faced two problems because of the 70 miles an hour southerly gales which blew day after day. Refueling the destroyers involved unjustified risks in such conditions, and cold as it was not nearly cold enough to suit the scientists. One day, weather report said it was colder in Yorkshire. This anxiety was reflected in a signal from Lieutenant Commander Wilde in the destroyer St. Kitts. "We have been nursing one icicle on the forecastle and despaired of his life, but this morning there is hair on his chest and he's the father of twins." Captain Terry replied, "I shall be glad to be godfather." When the wind dropped, we edged our way in among the ice floes, and three brave fellows went swimming in experimental survival suits, reporting that the exertion had them sweating, but they suffered intense pain as feeling returned later to their exposed hands. Among the special duties allocated was that of ornithologist imposed on the young ship's doctor, who was required to identify and record all bird life encountered. This came to the ears of the major marines. And one day, the young doc's afternoon zest was interrupted by the ringing of his cabin phone. An excited voice demanded that he should bring his bird book to the quarterdeck at once to confirm the presence of a red-crested leatherneck. Hurriedly dragging on the necessary several layers of clothing, the young doctor grabbed his book and, thrusting his way out into the gale, found only a ginger marine. For a couple of weeks, my Arctic diary was splashed over the leader page back in London, forging a link between the 1,500 men of the forces and their families at home. Then it was time for another Jackstay ride, this time to join the supply tanker Wave Premier, which gave me my third Blue Nose certificate for the homeward voyage. Does Blue...